Hello, I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois, and this is Positive Leadership, the podcast that helps you grow as an individual, a leader, and ultimately as a global citizen. IKEA is the world's largest furniture retailer. Roughly 882 million of us visited IKEA stores last year. Driven by IKEA's vision to create a better everyday life for many people, it is the Inca Group which brings the IKEA brand to its customers. My guest today, Jesper Brodin, CEO of Inca Group, is well known for his exceptional leadership qualities. Under his guidance, the group has not only embraced stakeholder governance, but has also set new benchmarks for corporate sustainability. By 2030, IKEA is committed to only using renewable and recycled materials and to reduce the company's total climate footprint by an average of 70% per product.
Being climate smart means being resource smart, means being cost smart. So obviously there are areas and decisions to be taken. There are shifts in legislation that needs to happen and so forth. But our general mindset is that climate smart is going to help us make IKEA economically much better in the future. Not only in the future, we see the evidence all around us right now.
It was super exciting to sit down with Jesper to talk about corporate sustainability in driving large-scale change, the importance of risk-taking in positive leadership, and his achievements as a singer in a heavy metal band. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Stay with us to the end. Can you tell us to start with about your childhood and the way your parents, your family, helped define some of your core beliefs, your values, and who you are as a person?
I think, you know, when I reflect upon my childhood growing up in the 80s in Sweden, one thing that sticks out for me that I realize now being 50 plus is that there was sort of an era where we all believed in that from now on things will only get better. Mm. My parents had a better life standard than their parents, and there was something in passing on the optimism. And I think it sits with me also as a warm memory of those years, but also sometimes as a struggle, being in a world where things are going up, down, yes, left, right, yeah, in many aspects. And that deeply disturbs me. And I realize it has a little bit to do with my childhood, probably.
I've had a number of wonderful guests on the podcast, including successful CEOs, who share with us some unique moments in their lives, and in a way, change them forever. A couple of examples I had. Doug Conant, the former CEO of Campbell Soup in the US. He was fired when he was actually 32, and as a result, started to consider what was holding him back from realizing his full potential. So he was really on the wrong start, he made it. Yet he ended as a CEO. Another leader I'm sure you know well, former Unilever CEO Paul Polman, right? He shared with us on the podcast this crucible moment in 2008 when he was caught up in a terrorist attack at the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai. Wow. An experience which made him realize the profound link between poverty and violence and changed his life as well. And last but not least, very, very exciting leader, Bozoma St. John's. Used to be boss at Netflix and Apple as well. She lost her husband Peter from cancer, and based on that deeply, involving experience in her life, she's made a big decision. Actually, she actually even wrote a book on that, to live her life urgently. So I gave you those examples, but I'm sure you'd like to share one defining moment in your life, wow, Jesper, that had a profound impact on the leader you've become today.
The thing that pops to mind instantly for me, so I had my first international assignment was with IKEA.
Yeah.
I applied for the job as a country manager for the trading setup and structure in Pakistan.
I heard that, yeah.
And I got the job. I was 25 years old.
Yes.
And funny enough, which is a story in itself, after a year, I asked my manager who came from a visit on Singapore, how come you take a 25-year-old, no IKEA experience, no experience of Pakistan, and offer this opportunity? And then he told me I was the only one who applied for the job. So I think sometimes we think we are special, don't we? But moving to Pakistan was a defining moment in my career, riddled by conflicts those days. They were basically, from a security perspective, it was partly a dangerous place. At the heart of society, there was a number of industrialists that I would say had an incredibly modern view on people and business. And we built the business together, which I've, of course was the reason I was there. What became a struggle for me personally was to see some of the values or the principles or the even the structures in society was not there when it comes to both the people and planetary aspects. And I remember having a bit of a personal crisis also on one hand, wanting to perform, wanting to show myself as a leader. At the same time, seeing things and experiencing things that were difficult to digest, which then became not only for me, but these were the times I think when IKEA woke up to a responsibility as with a question to say, do we apply our values only on our in-house, or does that apply for
every country where we operate?
End-to-end, so to say. Yeah. And luckily, we took the decision to go that route. And the defining thing for me was, I thought at that moment that would mean sacrifice in business or whatnot. But so my journey throughout IKEA has been to actually be part of proving that it is good business to be a good business. So that happened in Pakistan, which was, you know, incredibly strong from both environmental and people side. And as we develop the business, which is still doing great, by the way.
Was there in particular any personal or corporate value that you felt was most at risk and that you are tested, right? As a young leader in Pakistan, leading IKEA there and say, well, should I be firm on that value? Or maybe not because the societal construct that you just discussed, which is very different from Sweden for sure.
The conflict for me was, how can we create better life for consumers and not for people in the value chain? How could that contradiction be okay? And I guess at those days, we then came to the conclusion, being also new in our expansions, these were new dilemmas for IKEA, not only for me, but we came to the conclusion it was not possible. There would be a denial for all of us. So thereby started the long journey for us on actually, how do you find a way to not only serve your consumers, but actually include everyone in your value chain, which I think we do today from IKEA Foundation to supply chain to ourselves, our employees, our partners, and our customers.
That question that Jesper was grappling with at the time is a tricky one. To what extent should a company's core beliefs and principles extend outside its four walls? A multinational company like IKEA has thousands of first, second, and third tier suppliers, and it's not easy to control their mode of operations. Realizing transparency in every stage of a company's supply chain network can be very complex. Their lowest level suppliers may be from markets where there is little or no interest in enforcing sustainability initiatives, all of which makes it really important to have a code of conduct for suppliers, setting out clear expectations and ways of working for environmental, social, and working conditions. IKEA introduced its code of conduct for suppliers back in 2000s. 5 years after Jesper took up that job in Pakistan. Thanks so much. And thanks so much for having raised your hand to go to Pakistan, because I think it was a wise while actually courageous decision you took at the time.
Well, I got the advice from a couple of people. But my cousin used to be into China, into trading. And he also said, you know, if you take the risk and take the chance, the loss is very little, but the gain, if you make it in Pakistan,
it's enormous.
You have an opportunity to make a name for yourself within the company. And I think he was right, after all.
That's a wonderful advice. So actually, early in your career as well, I think, Jesper, you benefited from some great advice from a mentor, which was to learn as much as you can and take every opportunity to educate yourself and participate to the fullest in all work activities. And perhaps more importantly, to avoid following the shimmering objectives of a title. So can you tell us about that advice and how it influenced you back then and hopefully continues to influence you today, although you are at the very top now of the company today. So.
No, but I still remember when you mentioned it, I still remember, and I think a lot of young leaders maybe who have the opportunity to listen to this would agree to a certain stress of what is this going to lead to? What is my next step and so on? And I had lots of that anxiety. And starting in Pakistan, I it was important for me not to be forgotten, so to say, in any ways. But the advice I got was really to focus on the opportunity that you have at hand. And it seems like a basic and simple advice. But it gave me calm and it gave me focus. Yeah. And ever since, I have decided with myself that I don't, all the thoughts about what's going to happen next, I simply push them away. Mm. And that helps me not only focus, but it helps me be happy what I do.
Yes.
But it also helps me to avoid, which I've done a couple of times, opportunities of promotion or other job opportunities, which would maybe be smart from a career planning perspective. Mm. And I try to avoid that and look at how can I develop myself.
Yes.
And in the maybe best advice I ever got was from my mother, actually, when I was young. And that was as simple as to say, if you find something where you're, she said, Jesper, if you find something where you're good at and that also makes you happy,
do it.
Then that's a good place to be. I know sometimes we might be good at things, but it doesn't really make us happy. I have a lot of things I'm not good at. but the combination of the two, I think, leads to something more than a career, right?
I more than agree with you. But let's go back, not just to you, but to your company's history, which is pretty amazing. KEA was founded in 1943 in Almult, Sweden, by Ingvar Kamprad. The IK, I mean, the famous IK in IKEA. When I hosted Paul Polman a podcast, he told us as well about the story of Unilever's inception at the end of the 19th century in Britain to address the issues of hygiene in society. And how, as he became the CEO, he took the founder's core values and translated that into the needs of today to reconnect the entire company and leadership team with Unilever's roots and social mission. So, as the incoming CEO, when you took your role as CEO, did you find it important to refresh your team and employees' memory on IKEA's history and to tell the story of Ingvar Kamprad?
I would say both and. So Ingvar was a visionary. He was a business entrepreneur.
Yeah.
He was not necessarily so interested in strategy or administration or structure. So
it was a vision.
Vision and then hands-on was his style. And over the years, I think he grew. As the company became successful, he grew an interest and passion in how do we actually contribute to the goodness of this world. Mm. Actually, the early 80s, he gave away the group to set up a structure of a foundation, which still is the sole owner of the company. Mm. So there's €0 that leaves our system. Either it's reinvested into the company or it's given to charitable purposes, which is quite beautiful.
It is.
So, to a certain extent, the values that he represented, I believe, are timeless. The values of togetherness, the values of leading through setting good examples, the idea of actually having a purpose, serving humanity rather than just earning money. So all of these are good. At the same time, I like to believe there is it's important not to strike a balance, but to strike a dynamic relation between loving the past and creating the future.
Of course.
And there is, of course, a risk in a strong concept company like IKEA that we become arrogant, we become afraid of accepting the challenges of change or changing society. So when I started this assignment, I realized through customers and coworkers that, painfully enough, that we had been maybe leaning too much towards our past successes. So we were a little bit also in line of your business, Jean-Philippe. We were very analog. We had pushed to the future everything digital, not everything, but a lot. And we hadn't really taken a deep thought about the business operating model for the future.
Yeah.
So I think, love the past, but you need to stay very open and alert to what's happening that places you into the future, like you referred to Paul Polman. He did so elegantly to translate into the next model, so to say.
No, I love that statement you made. Actually, very similar in a way to what Satya Nadella, my manager and CEO, of course, Microsoft, has said once. Honor your past, your traditions, but lead with innovation to shape the future. It's like you need to balance both, actually.
You need to. And I think the interesting thing is that if you put them up against each other, the past is concrete, it's clear, it's defined. The future is not. Yeah. So the future is more fragile.
Yeah.
Ideas are more fragile. And therefore, I think one of the values that our founder always kept central was the right and the obligation to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And the drive for entrepreneurship. And still, I have many moments when I'm that makes me a bit concerned as a big company and big group that we are rejecting the new a little bit too much. So there are many ways we try to go about that. My most desperate moment, I've issued what I call Go Bananas cards, which
go
I'm
handing
out.
Go Bananas, okay.
Yes, yes.
What is it?
It's an idea. Yeah. So basically the card gives you a license. It looks like a driver's license, but it gives you an encouragement to make mistakes. Mm. And if you make a mistake and you have to apologize, I have already co-signed the excuse there. So you have a friend in me if you then do something that didn't really work out well.
I love the idea of Jesper's Go Bananas card, which promise the others that they won't face any repercussions from him if they try something new that just doesn't pay off. Having a risk-taking culture is something he works hard to cultivate, which makes sense, really. It's been an important part of IKEA's success in the past. It was partly because of the company's willingness to break with convention that it set up its first showroom in the 1950s at a time when most of its competitors relied on mail-order catalogs. The decision to introduce restaurants to home furnishing stores was hardly a safe bet. Many companies want to be innovative, but few are willing to accept that failed experiments come with the territory. More business leaders should license their teams to go bananas if they want to close the innovation gap.
IKEA wasn't just there. It was developed through entrepreneurs, risk takers, and probably 9 out of 10 experiments didn't work out as we thought. But it led to the IKEA that we see today. So we need to continue that spirit.
There have been some very significant challenges that I know you faced as a CEO, from the global pandemic through to war in Europe, of course, till today, unfortunately. And you've expressed before that it's been a very humbling experience for you, right? So can you talk about what you found most challenging and how you've managed to steer the company through those crises? And not only to survive, actually, to thrive. And to finish with, I would say, how much it has changed your approach to what is called usually crisis management, right? When you've got a big challenge happening somewhere in the world globally, in the way you actually do your role as a CEO today, Jesper.
So these last years have been so challenging, I think, for the world, for all of us, and definitely for myself as well in this role. I still vividly recall the first week of the pandemic. You know, we all go through the cycle of change. First, it's in denial, then it's an irritation, and then the true grasping of the seriousness of the situation and how it was disrupting all the plans and the model of IKEA, if you like. So I'm not typically a person that have difficulty sleeping, but I can tell you there were a couple of days and weeks in the early phase of the pandemic where the predictions having... At a moment, I think we had out of 450 stores, only 20 were open.
Wow.
And we were predicting massive red. And if you, with no exaggeration, we were seeing a scenario of layoffs and closures and basically a threat to IKEA's existence.
Yeah.
So the interesting learning, I think, is maybe one is this speed of accepting change, right? If you're good at that and if you... If you have the motto of course, hoping for the best, but expecting the worst.
Yes.
And then I think what was so cool with the IKEA network was that we realized we don't have a map for the situation. There is nothing in the drawer to help us, but we have a good compass with our values.
Yeah.
So we basically took the decision with all our leaders to say, do what's right. We were basically dictating to say that the plans, the 2 years, 2.5 years plans we had for online, we said to the organization, it would be nice if we could do it in 6 weeks.
6 weeks, wow. That's...
Yes, and of course, and the cool thing was we were actually capable in most places to do that. So at that time, actually, IKEA didn't have online. We had one or two markets experimenting, but digital, everybody, I mean, the top managers were out in our... with the masks on and packing goods in our stores. We converted all our stores into fulfillment centers.
Yeah.
And luckily, since we had listened to our customers 2 years earlier, we actually had started the service setups and the online capabilities digitally. Otherwise, we would have been in deep problems. So basically, unions, everybody was there to say, now we actually roll up our sleeves and we save the company together. So I think 6-8 weeks later, we were actually in a... I give you one example in a very interesting moment because In the early stages, we were actually, as furlough was proposed from many governors, we were signing up for that. 8 weeks later, we said, no, but we're going to make it. We're going to be not make a lot profit, but we're going to be in the black. And we actually had a moral discussion to say it's wrong for us that give the furlough to somebody else. So we actually reversed furlough in all markets.
That's amazing.
And I thanked the government and said, thank we actually don't need this.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, in many legislations, it has never happened before.
So
it was a new experiment. So that was a humbling moment, I must say.
I'm sure. I mean, amazing experiences. I mean, in two different ways. Well, you said first, it's about empowering your people and having confidence in their decisions during the pandemic, saying, you guys know what's going on in Poland or Mexico or Sweden or France. You take the decision, take care of the people and customers and so on. And number two, you probably made a switch and clearly to e-commerce strategically that may not have ever happened. I mean, I don't know, right? In terms of the slowness you had, you said.
I think it would have taken many more years. So in a way, with all the respect of the human suffering of the pandemic and the crisis, the pandemic helped IKEA to become omnichannel in more than double speed. And you can say today we are doing about a quarter of the business online.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it starts to flatten out like that, but you can also say in metropolis areas, we're up to 50%. But we not only have it in place with services and distribution, we found the IKEA model in doing it in an effective way. So it's scalable, actually. So our fear was that it would be economically challenging, but we have found a way to make it actually not only helping our top line, but actually drive economics through the company. And absolutely, the pandemic was the catalyst because it became a survival factor for us.
No, very interesting and insightful, actually, crisis opportunity. I'd like to shift gears now, Jesper, and talk about some of the other developments you've made with IKEA. As we record this episode, we've been experiencing in Europe, in many parts of the world, one of the very warmest summers and years ever. And as a company, you've set some very ambitious targets around sustainability, and you've said in different instances that this is your top priority. I was interested to read the introduction you wrote for The Business of Building a Better World, The Leadership Revolution That Is Changing Everything, where you talk about this decade being crunch time for companies and governments. And as a reminder for listeners, IKEA's vision is to create a better everyday life for the many people. And you want to inspire and enable 1 billion people to live healthier and more sustainable lives within the limits of the planet by 2030, which is a very exciting vision. So now, from vision to reality, Jesper, can you tell me about not just, of course, the targets you've set for the company, but could you share with us the three most challenging and controversial decisions you had to make at the CEO on how to help to make real progress towards IKEA becoming a net zero company? So beyond the statements, what have you done and what have you found super hard to do to make it happen?
From an ethical perspective, knowing what we know today, and we all regret that back 30 years ago, we had absolutely no understanding or even 20 years ago, no real conception of the damage that we are causing to the planet and ourselves. That is, of course, gave us a very late start to everything. That's why this decade, this is it. This is the biggest existentialistic moment for humanity to get this right.
Yeah.
So from a moral perspective, no, we cannot hand this over to the next generation. It's now. Secondly, if I look at IKEA's customer base, we have recently done the updated study of interviewing 33,000 people in 30 markets.
Yep.
And the awareness of climate change and the worry is way now above 70. There is no place below 70.
Wow.
It's very consistent from US to China to Germany and so forth.
Everywhere.
If you go down in generations, it increases. And as such, it's very clear that our customers expect us to be a leader. That's going to increase. And I think people will start deselecting brands who are not doing whatever they can.
For sure.
It doesn't have to be perfect, but you need to have the intent. The third, an interesting aspect that people misunderstand over and over again is that this should come at a premium. It's very clear from our customers to say, we expect you to fix this. We don't have the money. to pay extra for this. You need to find a way to do it. So we have accepted that.
Uh-huh.
One of the difficult decisions is maybe about belief.
Mm.
So because the typically CEOs and companies want to have a plan before you commit to something. And in this case, I think IKEA, who's known for wanting that, have actually been braving saying that even if we don't have all the details right, we don't have the time not to commit. So we need to believe in that we can get this right. I do believe there has been difficult decisions to...
Yeah, give me one.
Without having all the answers.
Give me one of such decisions you made that you could share, obviously, with our listeners that has been not easy to take with your employees and people.
We decided a few years ago to cancel our total light source business, in the incandescent lighting bulbs and so forth. It's big business, big margin, and we decided it must be wrong with the knowledge we had of climate change and whatnot. So we went for LED, and at that time, the prices of LED were, I think, 20-fold compared to today.
Wow.
So we took that bet, hoping that we would be able to scale up and make a good business case, which we were capable to do. Looking at the business today, that was absolutely a brilliant decision. But at the moment, it felt like almost careless from a business perspective. And we were criticized for that decision internally.
Yeah.
It turned out to be the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I've had similar when we developed the code of conduct, which actually leads back to the days of Pakistan and the years shortly after. We developed a code of conduct in IKEA with about 80 questions on both sustainability from a people and planet point of view. There was a deep worry that we would become more expensive. Interesting enough, motivation grow, productivity, quality. There were so many effects that actually helped us do the opposite, to take out cost from the value chain. So I would say my experience and my advice to people is, if it is the right thing, the thing that wants to happen, you have to trust that the economic sense will be there. And I do believe in all of this hesitation that happens in so many places currently and waiting with investments and so forth.
Yeah.
This is a game of too early, too late.
Or too late, yeah.
And you need to pick the right too early. You don't want to be in the too late here.
Yeah.
And that means you need to take some personal risk as a leader as well, of course.
I'd like to just pause for a moment and pick up on the point Jesper is making. It's a wonderful reinforcement of the need for risk-taking. The climate emergency demands action from all of us. And when you think about the sustainability commitments some companies are taking or not taking, hesitating in many places, waiting for investment and so forth, there's probably needs to be more risk-taking starting at the very top. In recent years, there's been a growing emphasis across the world of measuring a business impact on society, the environment, and how transparent and accountable it is. Backed up by the coming reporting requirement from the EU, the so-called Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, which will require thousands of companies to report. On the previous podcast episode, I talked with Sir Ronald Cohen, who highlighted the need for a shift towards impact investing and importance of accurately measuring impact. Jesper has talked about the economic benefits he's seeing from the choices he's made to reduce his carbon footprint. He gave those LED light bulbs as an example. But I want you to know how he sees the role of measuring impact and how he balances that with his profitability promise to shareholders.
No, I think, I'm deeply convinced that the profitability will come by being on the right side of the economic transition. And by the way, also the right side of humanity.
Mm.
But you can say that this is definitely a topic that needs fact-based approach.
Yes.
So you can say the starting point and my encouragement to all companies, if you don't yet have that in place, is to make your what the technical term of scope 3 analysis of your footprint, carbon footprint. So that would then, in an IKEA, it's quite easy to understand in a way. You can say scope 3 is like everything. So in the IKEA point of view, the upstream would be raw material, production, transportation. You have retailing, you have customer transportation, and you have use in life at home, and finally afterlife. So there are 7 silos, if you like. And then you need to know what is the carbon impact? So you don't act blindly on what your gut tells you. For instance, a lot of people including myself, thought that transport would be the biggest contributor for carbon, which is not.
It's not the case.
So in our case, it's actually 50% raw material is the big aspect. One reason it's 50% is because also we have been faster in addressing some of the other ones. So what you need to do, you need to have the fact-based approach. You need to target the different areas with different solutions. And then, interesting enough, you know, ripe the economic benefits of such as well. And then I would say there is certain aspects which I think more and more people are also awakening to, that these different aspects are connected. So circularity connects all of them.
Yeah.
If you crack circularity, you can actually get benefits in more of these dimensions. So definitely, as the world, to your question, is speeding up legislation, we working together in World Economic Forum's yes. Climate Alliance.
Yeah.
We advocate for simplicity and alignment, of course.
Yes.
This is an area that invites to technicality, technocracy, bureaucracy. And it's an area where there can be, in the worst case, that companies need to have different reporting regimes while everybody's, at the essence, trying to strive for the same thing. So we welcome the reporting. We welcome the transparency. But we also want a bit more collaboration to simplify and align across borders.
Across borders and across legislation as well. I'd like to come back to one point you made, which I think is one of the big bets you are doing underpinning your sustainability commitment. Building a full circular economic model and 100% of your products circular by 2030. I think that's one of your strategic goals. So what does it actually mean to share with our listeners who are not necessarily experts in circularity, Jesper? And can you give us a concrete example of one of circular products that your consumers buy from IKEA today? And how do you plan then to systematize that circularity model to everything you produce, you sell, and then you service after the products are being used by the customers?
It's hard work. To some extent, it's a total transformation of the economy, if you like. But if I start at the end, it's an interesting area because it's riddled by myths. One of the myths is that we should stop consuming, if you say, or the aspect of that consumption is bad, which it is. So the interesting thing is, from a climate science point of view, a fact-based point of view, one of the mitigations is, of course, reducing unnecessary consumption, prolonging life, supporting secondhand. All these tactics, if you like, are part of our climate plan.
Yes.
But at the essence, in a growing world population, you have to address the core consumption. If you think about the simplicity of by 2050, we need to be at net zero.
Yeah.
So does that mean we would have consumption by 2030 and then have zero consumption by 2050? No, of course not. That would be the end of humanity. We can't eat, sleep, etc. So we cannot abandon the core of consumption itself. And if I give you, I have several great examples from vegetables to whatnot, but one of the coolest is we have recently, the last 4 or 5 years, in a collaboration with the Dutch government, addressed taking back mattresses.
Mattresses, yeah.
So mattresses might be 8% of our sales or something, but maybe doubling climate footprint is quite bulky and material intense. Now, the interesting thing is it was difficult for us to find economy in bringing back these products and make new, because the system didn't allow for it. So what happened was that the Dutch government went in to stop subsidizing incineration of mattresses and then imposed a law to say that you have to drop your old mattress on a collection point. Now imagine 17 million people. In average, a mattress is 10 years. So 1.7 million mattresses per year goes to incineration. Now we set up a system, and today we expanded it to 4 units. We have a capacity to take back every mattress in Netherlands, not only our share.
Wow.
And here comes the good news.
Yeah.
It's good business.
Okay.
When we break up the polyester, the foam, the metal, we sell it back into the supply chain to make new products. It's not the best business I've ever seen, but it's actually making a lot of business sense.
Yeah.
And thereby, you're not prolonging the life of mattresses only or minimizing unnecessary. And by the way, very few people buy a mattress on a spontaneous level, right? It's a necessity-driven purchase.
Yeah.
So now we are capable, through plugging in EV transport in the logistics side, to actually create a consumption solution for mattresses that is climate neutral, which is amazing. So when people say this is a vision or an idea, but it's not realistic, here you have one of the cases. And if I may, Jean-Philippe, because I think this is important, people have hard to believe that it's possible to, you have to sacrifice growth for decoupling carbon. So IKEA, since the 2016, report a sales increase of 24.8%.
Wow.
So we grew since then. We report a decoupling of carbon of absolute minus 13.6.
Wow.
So it's not relative, it's absolute. So
absolute, yeah.
That's one example to say it seems to be a good idea to grow and decouple carbon. So basically, we are currently updating our goals because we're almost at the regional 2030 goal.
Yes.
We also need to update that because of new insights in science and so forth.
Yeah.
But it gives me hope that decoupling carbon is a good business idea, actually.
Well, wonderful example you took and you share with all of us, Jesper, of circularity. And I'm sure you're busy doing that on every product and changing the mix of your materials as well to again, get to that net zero IKEA even sooner than later. It looks like you've got a plan, actually.
We do. And it's humbling. In some areas, it's easier. Some, we're looking for the answers. As you said, it might even be that we need to abandon some materials and find new solutions. So some of it is not easy, but we definitely, the 50% target 2030, which is the one that we spend most time on right now.
Yes.
It seems to be in our reach.
Yeah. So one of the ways, Jesper, to get inspiration, but also to get some real solution, I found myself, and within Microsoft and outside Microsoft with my different roles, is to partner with change makers, social entrepreneurs, what is being called these days impact entrepreneurs around the world. There are a number of wonderful companies whose North Star is all about having a positive impact in the world. So your company has a long tradition, and actually we are partnering together with the WEF, with the Schwab Foundation, with this World Economic Forum Alliance for Social Entrepreneurship, to ensure that big enterprise can not only get inspiration, but actually can procure product services from such entrepreneurs. So can you tell us more about how IKEA has been involved and is involved with social entrepreneurs, impact entrepreneurs around the world, both in terms of strategy, but also hands-on experimentation products, and what do you expect from that in the future?
Well, there are different exciting opportunities. I think one of the starting points for us to address social entrepreneurs, we had the opportunity to invite the now late Professor Hans Rosling, who was, I think, the mastermind of understanding long-term demographic changes and an optimist of rank. He came to us and he took a vision of serving the many people, and he pointed at the gap. He said, you have, on one hand, you have your customers, you have yourself, your suppliers, then you have nothing, and then you have IKEA Foundation, who basically do philanthropic work for the people who have the least, maybe.
Yeah.
But he pointed us in a direction to say, there are so many people who the barrier to be a big supplier to you is just too big. So we started a social entrepreneurship in two ways.
Yeah.
One was actually in the close to our retailing where we work, for instance, with maybe there can be an entrepreneur who works with stitching or giving services to IKEA products. There could be circularity, secondhand, and so forth. And the second was basically to look into offer job opportunities for people through creating products, sometimes more handicraft related. The point was, though, to see that other people have an opportunity to build something from the ground, which is basically a program that we also applied together with the IKEA Foundation's direction. We actually did, for instance, set up such an entrepreneurship in Jordan. It was one of my favorite projects to actually offer job opportunities to refugees from Syria, from the crisis. So in a way, you can say it serves our social mission quite well.
Yeah.
It gives us an opportunity to learn. Then you have the total other end, of course, where we are investing into new technologies. We recently, I think yesterday, announced a collaboration with H2 Steel to basically now introduce green steel in all our properties and real estate. So that's not a social entrepreneur, but it's an entrepreneur who starts from very little and has a vision about the new economy, which we like to support.
I think we need both, actually. We need both the inspiration of social entrepreneurs and also from I would say innovation-led companies. I'd like to finish a couple of questions because on leadership, going back to the leadership discussion we had early in your days, in an article you co-wrote for Fortune a couple of years ago, you said that we need to scrap the old leadership model and replace it with one that places humanity, humility, and brave action at the heart of everything we do, which is something I totally agree with. Indeed, I recently had Stephen M. R. Covey on a podcast to talk about his latest research on leadership, a new model that he's explored and written about in his book, Trust and Inspire. And your leadership style is very resonant of the ideas he proposes. What he said is, in Trust and Inspire, it's about a new way of leading that starts with the belief that people are creative, collaborative, and full of potential. People with this kind of leader are inspired to become the best version of themselves and to produce their best work. People don't want to be managed. People want to be led. So how do you see this new way of leadership developing? And what are the most important lessons of leadership you've learned along the way to become a role model in doing more of that?
One of the things personally that I've learned to accept and maybe also change my own nature in a way. So to accept dilemmas. I think these days, I think when I run into some juicy dilemmas, normally they are make them the best friend. Take your time to explore them, expand your horizon, because in true dilemmas lies very often the great opportunities to make an impact. And I do believe myself, I've come to a point also in life where I think I find it totally uninteresting to work for making money or making somebody rich or to drive growth as the only element. So I think the future belongs to, I hope and believe, to leaders, companies, organizations that has a purpose to serve humanity.
Yes.
I don't see the contradiction between the business opportunity and doing good. I think that is the new corporate environment that we will look for. Of course, you can say, when you talked about Unilever, it started with a beautiful idea.
Yeah.
Microsoft started with a beautiful idea to serve humanity. Of course, there is always an entrepreneur and a spirit, but very soon there comes something more fundamental and deep within it. So I believe to a certain extent, managing, maybe step one in leadership is about management and managing things or a team. Step two maybe is leading transformations. Microsoft, like IKEA, have undergone great transformation. You need to have believers, flag carriers. You need to instigate momentum, not perfection. Then I think level three for me, maybe it's also with the respect of our founder, as the deep insight of understanding that culture is even stronger. So if you can invest in culture, you will have resilience for the unexpected and tough times. And right now I'm curiously experimenting what I think might be the next level. And I call it servant leadership. I don't know if it's a term like that.
Oh, it's been existing.
I believe to a certain extent.
Yes.
Yeah. But I believe truly that if you take out your own ego, if you take on your and look at what is it actually that you can do. And in the servant leadership thinking, it leads you also to believe that the ultimate goal for you as a leader is that you're not needed anymore, if you see my point. So how can you contribute to change and building something.
Yeah.
And when you're done, then basically it can continue without your energy and passion.
Love it.
So that's where I am right now in my leadership development. Much left to learn.
You know, Positive Leadership Podcast, we often talk to leaders, all kind of leaders actually, very different types of people, in the way they find resources in themselves to create a positive energy. And I'd like you to talk about the way you create your moments of calm in your day, the way you relax and unwind. I understand you are a sailor, and I understand that I've been recently in the islands in Sweden. You need to be a good sailor. Mm. But also you love music. As a matter of fact, you play guitar. I understand you play actually really well guitar. And you've said before that playing guitar is your yoga, and you do it every day. So tell me about your guitar practice. Are you in a band? What kind of music do you play? And how does it help you create positive energy? Not just within yourself, but with others, right? In your days, in your weeks, when you have some tough decisions to make.
It's an important quality to be able to be self-generating of positive energy.
Yeah.
For me, originally, introverted nature means that I need time for myself, I need time to focus. So I think if I look at the hours I play guitar, I'm absolutely hopeless. I should have been much, much better at this point, but I'm currently the lead singer in a heavy metal band, the best heavy metal band in Hong Kong.
Wow.
Yes, yes. And we haven't met in a while, I have to admit, but the band members are still there and we've had a lot of fun. I do believe it's important to find your source of recuperation and focus. And again, music for me works like meditation. My wife is a yoga teacher and she helps me with meditation, but music works like the best meditation because it totally relaxes the mind and shifts my focus, to something else. So I love that. That's my hobby and that's my way of getting a moment of recuperation. So definitely.
I can feel it.
And there is a lot of people who share that, by the way.
No, my really last question, because I know you're super busy, Jesper. You know, we are in 2023. So what would be your coaching message, 2023, for young 25 years old Jesper, starting his professional career, not necessarily in IKEA, in any place in the world, maybe in Sweden, maybe in Pakistan or somewhere else? What do you think are the most meaningful life lessons, leadership lessons you've had to share back with this young Jesper to apply in his life in 2023 as he gets started? What would that be?
Wow, what an opportunity. So I have 25 advice now. No, to keep it short, you know, I think the advice I would give to myself would be twofold, I think. Don't worry so much, I would tell myself.
Yeah.
I think when I look back over the years, I've worried too much about the future and so on.
Yeah.
As such, I think breed the optimism within yourself. And it will guide you to the right places. And I think then finally, that's very related to my mother's old advice to try to look for the things you're good at. If you don't find it, keep trying.
Yes.
And then find the place where you're really happy. And if you find both, that is a career. Forget about titles, forget about money. All of these things will come. So look for what you're good at and look for what makes you happy.
One of the things that really struck me about this discussion is Jesper's openness and authenticity. And it's telling that he should come back to his mother's advice there, that he should place such value on a pursuit of happiness, taking time to nurture yourself, to seek out joy in every experiences, keeps you healthy and brings you strengths. You've been listening to Positive Leadership Podcast with me, Jean-Philippe Courtois. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and click the share button you have to send the episode to many of your friends. And if you're looking to start a journey of personal growth and positive impact, why not head to my LinkedIn page and sign up to my monthly newsletter, Positive Leadership and You. Thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.